I know that there are a number of people who have come to the Buddhist Society for the first time this evening, and I welcome you on behalf of the whole community. I would like to express some reservation on my next subject for those who are completely new to the Buddhist community, because I'm going to talk about one of the great taboos. I have been asked to speak on this subject today, and it is a very pertinent and very relevant subject, because it is about the process of dying. And it is very pertinent to myself, because just the other day I was informed that one of our members of the lay community was very sick and had a stroke in hospital. I visited her many times, and when I went in, I was able to speak to her, because this lady has been a very devout Buddhist and had come and stayed in our monastery, had practiced meditation, and was used to the concepts of developing the mind, and also the very clear Buddhist concept of cultivating the mind and making it very calm and tranquil before death. And so I gave her instructions, even though she wasn't conscious. It was obvious that just my words of advice and the chanting, the Buddhist chanting that I did, was very soothing and calming. You could see that on the breath, and the functions of the body calmed down. She became less agitated and more still. And then the last day, I was able to go and visit her in the morning, and I again told her to establish mindfulness, to make the mind peaceful, to let go, and to give up attachments, and to let go of the body, and then also was able to do some chanting. And at the end, her family had gathered around, and I also gave them some advice to give their mother permission to pass away and to let go, to allow her to go on to a new life peacefully and calmly without a lot of grief. And after speaking to them, I turned to the lady who was obviously dying and said, now the Achan will go back to the monastery. And when I said those words, she took a last breath, almost as if she was leaving as well. And just watching that process, the process of, it was one exhalation and no inhalation, made me very aware of how subtle life is. It is just that much. Either one inhalation and no exhalation, or one exhalation and no inhalation. When the breath element stops going in and out of the body, then the other functions of the body start to break up. And then the mind leaves. The mind breaks up as well. So I wanted to cover this area and discuss it from a Buddhist point of view, because it is extremely crucial for all of us. It's very relevant. And without a willingness to explore, to inquire, to give intellectual understanding, but also to a willingness to open the possibility, open up to the potential, open up to the idea, if we remain resistant, if we say, well, I don't want to talk about this subject, I don't even want to contemplate it, it won't happen to me, then we're in a state of denial, and that doesn't lead to knowledge, it doesn't lead to wisdom, it doesn't lead to understanding, it's not really suitable for a person who really is seeking inquiry into the unknown. What happens? What goes on? And that's what going to do this evening, is discuss what actually happens here, what goes on, what can we know about this state and this process of what we call life and what we call the process of the ending of that life, and how are they interrelated, and how do they work. Because you find that if you understand one, then you'll understand the other. The reason sometimes we can't understand our own life is because we haven't looked at the potential for that life to change. And that's why I've been telling a story quite frequently at our monastery when people come to me with problems. And many of you have heard this story many times before, but I'll tell it because I think it is a very useful one. And it's the story of the emperor. And the emperor who had three very grave questions that were on his mind. And the first of those questions was, well, who's the most important person in the world? And of course, his ministers trying to ingratiate themselves with the minister, with the emperor, would say, of course you are. You're the most important person in the world. But he felt dissatisfied with that. And often in life we're telling ourselves the same thing, aren't we? That we're the most important person in the world, the most significant event to happen in this universe. But underlying that answer, we feel dissatisfied. It's not the real answer to that question. And the other kind of fundamental question that the emperor had was, what's the most important time in a person's life? And of course, the ministers would say, well, it was when you were born, or when you were crowned, when you came to power. And of course, that wasn't really satisfying. And the other fundamental question that the emperor had was, what's the most important thing to do in one's life? And some ministers would say, oh, the most important thing to do is go over and conquer that kingdom over there. Get more power, get more wealth, get more status, more prestige. Become a world-conquering monarch. And underlying that, there was a sense of, that's not really where it's at. That's not really true. And so whenever someone come to the kingdom, the emperor would ask them these three questions. Who's the most important person? What's the most important time? And what's the most important thing to do in life? Until one day he heard that there was a sage who lived on a mountain. And so the emperor decided, well, I'll go and seek out this wise man. So he took his retinue off with all his soldiers, got to the base of the mountain, and then had a change of heart. He thought, well, it's not really skillful to go and seek out these religious people with my soldiers intact, in tow. And also to be dressed as the emperor, then he may be put off, may not answer the questions, or may give me platitudes like everyone else. So he changed his clothing into the robes of a peasant, or the clothing of a peasant, and left his regalia there, and told his soldiers to wait and guard the bottom of the mountain. He was going to head up to see the sage by himself. And being an emperor who hasn't walked up a mountain very often, it took him a long time. By the time he got to the top of the mountain, it was starting to get late. It was getting dark. And so, being in a hurry, being a very busy man, he rushed into the cave, coughed a few times, trying to locate the sage. And he saw the sage sitting on a rock, very still, sitting meditation. So he coughed louder. Very important, busy person. And the sage sat very still. So he coughed louder. There was no response. And so the emperor, being impatient, turned to leave, but noticed that outside it got pitch black and the wild animals would be coming out. And so he became frightened and timid. He knew he couldn't leave, so he'd have to spend the night in the cave. So he stayed there for the night, and the sage sat meditation all night. And so the emperor was forced to sit there all night, waiting for dawn. Then finally, when dawn arrived, the emperor went out of the cave and went over to the edge of a great cliff and was looking over his kingdom. And looking out over his kingdom, he felt a sense of relief. For the first time in his life, he'd put down the burden. He'd put down responsibilities. And he was watching this beautiful sunrise. And then suddenly he heard this cough behind him, and he turned around as he was tottering on the edge of this cliff, and there was a sage standing there with a big sword pulled, drawn, as if to chop off his head, and not being able to step back because there was certain death, not being able to escape forward because there appeared to be certain death. The sage asked the emperor, "Who's the most important person? What's the most important time? And what's the most important thing to do?" And being faced by death for the first time, the emperor's mind stopped, became focused, and he understood. So he bowed down to the feet of the sage, and the sage put the sword down and said, "Now you understand. The most important person is the person you're with, be it yourself or be it others. They're the most important people. The most important time is the right here and right now. And the most important thing to do is to be totally aware of the here and now." And the emperor, understanding, was able to go down and lead his kingdom with skill, with compassion, and with wisdom. And if we understand that too, those three simple answers to those three profound questions, we too would be able to deal with our kingdoms, our realms, our family lives, our duties, our worlds with more skill. Because when we stop and face the reality that we can't go forward, we can't step back, and we can't be still, then we become very aware the present moment. We become aware of what's important. And that's what the contemplation of impermanence, the contemplation of cessation of things, the contemplation of death does, doesn't it? It makes things stop. It makes the mind sober. It makes the mind clear. It makes things be placed, or puts things into perspective and places them in perspective. What's important? And that's why one of the meditation subjects the Buddha instructed people, he once asked his attendant, the Venerable Ananda, he said, "Ananda, how many times a day do you contemplate your own death?" And Ananda, his attendant, said, "At least 7 times a day." And the Buddha said, "That's not enough. You should contemplate your death every in-breath and out-breath." Just think about that. If you were to think, "This is my last breath," do I want to die doing this, sitting here listening to a talk? Do I want to die with these thoughts? Do I want to die saying these words? And if you can honestly say, yes, I would be content. They seem noble things to do, to say, and think. I would be happy to die with a thought of loving kindness. I would be happy to die with a thought of compassion for all beings. I would be happy to die with a thought of renunciation and letting go. I would be happy to be doing an act of generosity and die at that moment. I would be happy to be doing some noble deed or noble service, or to be even sitting perfectly still. For a Buddhist monk to die in meditation would be probably, you'd get the most praise from your fellow monks. There was actually one very famous monk, his name was Lumpu Sao, and he was the teacher of Achan Man, who was a teacher of Achan Cha, if you know, have that connection. And Achan Sao was very old, and he was quite sick, and he traveled to a monastery, and the attendant monk who was looking after him went to pick him up. He traveled by boat, and then he walked from the wharf to the monastery, and assisted by his attendant, and the attendant wanted him to go back and rest straight away because he'd been traveling many hours, and he said no. Having just arrived in a monastery, I want to go to bow down to the shrine in the shrine hall, which is usually one of the first things a monk will do when entering a monastery, go down and bow to the shrine. And so he went into the shrine room against the wishes of the attendant monk who was wanting him to rest. And he bowed, put his robe over one shoulder and bowed three times. And on the last time, he didn't come up. And so the attendant monk waited a long time and then went over, felt his pulse, and he passed away. And he died bowing down. It was his last act. And to me, as a monk, that would be a nice way to go. Either die in meditation or bowing down to the Buddha. For me, that would be a nice way to go. But the most important thing is not so much what you're doing with your body, it's what you're doing with your mind. Because what actually happens at death, and that's actually important to know, we define the body and mind as five characteristics. There's firstly the physical body, the biological organ of the body or organism of the body, and then the mind. And the aspects of the mind are firstly thought, perception, and the ability to recall, memory, and consciousness. So we're able to think, we're able to perceive, we're able to remember, and we're consciously aware. Consciousness means to know. To know. We can know sight, we can know sound, we can know taste, we can know touch, we can know ideas. We can know when these things arise. And when those aspects of mind come together and there's a body, then there's life. The life faculty is sustained. And the life faculty is sustained through one's action, through karma. But, you know, there may be some point that the body can no longer sustain, the body gets too old. Then that aspect of mind has to leave that body and break up. There may be a cause through its karma, that life is cut off, very short, life is very short, or through an accident, and therefore the mind must leave that body. It's a bit like all of you having to come into this hall, you've left your cars out in the car park. The reason you use your car is a vehicle to get between A and B, but it's the driver which directs that car. Whether you come here or you go to the casino, that's not dependent on the car, it's dependent on the driver. The mind is what directs the body. It makes the body move, makes the body react, makes the body do things. Now this is actually, it does have significant and important ethical considerations. For example, back in the 1960s, Christian Bernard did the first heart operation, which we're all aware of. And that first heart transplant that created a complete new definition of life and death, particularly death, in the medical profession. Because prior to the first heart operation, the definition of a person dying was when the pulse stops, when the heartbeat stops. But if you want to do heart operations, you actually have to have a beating heart. You can't wait till the heart stops before you take it from the donor and put it into the recipient. So because of that very fact, that you need a beating heart, the medical profession redefined death as being brain dead. And so we have now, the current definition is not when the heart stops, but when there's no measurable brain waves or brain activity. So when one is brain dead, because when one has no mental or measurable mental activity, then you can still have a pumping, operating heart. Therefore, the heart can be removed from a donor and given to a recipient. So that is actually the major reason there was a redefinition from heart death to brain death. It's only in Japan that mainly these days where they still use the concept of measuring death from heart death, which makes them very difficult for them to have heart transplants in Japan. So it's actually very interesting because where is death? Is it when the heart stops? Or is it when the brain stops? Or is it when you can't measure the heartbeat just because of some instrument can't measure it? Or when you can't measure or detect some mental activity? And actually what we see is that actually the death process is a very long process. It is not just one point or one stage. It actually is a process. It is where something is decaying and breaking up. It's like the melting of a lump of ice, Ajahn Chah used to say. Where do you say that the ice is completely melted? It's a process. It's a gradual process, a gradual breaking up, a gradual slowing down. And what happens with the body is, say, the breath slows down until the breath element, the element of breathing in and breathing out, stops. And when the breath element stops, then over time the heat element of the body dissipates as well, isn't it? Because oxygen leads to internal combustion. We need oxygen to build energy for activity. And when the heat element goes, then the body cools down. And when the heat element goes, then gradually the water elements of the body will gradually dissipate as well. Over time, over a number of years, number of days, the body fluids will come out. And then eventually you're just left with the earth element. So when we start to look at a physical body in terms of its, you know, the elements that make it up, earth, fire, air and water, then it takes out the sense of me, the sense of mine, the sense of I, the sense of my loved one. And we just see a process, a natural process. And it diffuses the attachment, the clinging, that this process is me, this process is them, this process is mine. We just see a process happening. We can then let go. It's when we don't see it as a process, then we see it as something happening to me. And then the mind in Buddhism will go according to its karma, the things that the mind has done in the past. So if your mind has created lots of good thoughts, has done and trained itself in skillful ways, it's developed in skillful ways, then it will go in a skillful way. That is why it's very important to actually train yourself when you go to sleep at night, to train the mind to go to sleep with mindfulness, with clarity, following the breath as you go in and out, because it's very similar to letting go of the body at death. It's a way of just giving up. To go to sleep, you have to learn to relax. You have to learn to settle the body down and be comfortable in bed. If you are too interested in the body and the comfort of the body, you'll always be wriggling and moving. But it's when we give up our concern for the body and just relax and let the process happen, then we go to sleep. Now, one can go to sleep by just going into dullness. But there's another way of going to sleep that meditators use, which is to sleep with awareness, where the mindfulness and conscious awareness is so strong of the process of the body resting that you're aware that you're asleep. And that can happen, that you're actually consciously aware that the body is resting. And it's that sort of process that happens which helps in the process of dying. Because the most important thing you can do if you're ever around a dying person is to help them establish awareness. Help them to establish mindfulness, to die with clarity. One of the things that I was able to do for this lady who died recently was to suggest to the nurses that they don't give her morphine, because the nurse told me that she made some grimaces with her eyes even though she was unconscious, and the nurse thought that she may be in pain, was not aware whether she was or not, and decided to give her morphine just in case she was in pain. And I politely said that, you know, though I'm not a medical professional, from a Buddhist point of view, if she does not need the morphine, can endure the pain, then it's preferable that the morphine is not given if she can withstand the pain. And that person was a person who was aware of meditation and had meditated. And so I had enough confidence that she would be able to handle the pain. Because what morphine does is clouds awareness, it clouds clarity, it clouds mindfulness. And the Buddha said that your last thought moment is very crucial and very critical for the next life. Because how the mind is will condition, will spark the future birth. So if you're dying, then one wants to die with clarity and with calm, and not under the delusion or the distraction of some heavy drugs. A lot of people, the reason that they'll give or take morphine at their time of death is basically fear, isn't it? Fear of pain. The fear that I won't be able to handle the pain. The fear that we won't be able to be in control. The fear that it will be overcoming of us. But that's where, if you develop meditation, what you start to do is you actually start to observe the nature of feeling. We start when we're sitting here, like all of you are sitting here, and you're feeling pain in the body. So what we do is, instead of reacting to it with like and dislike, we're saying, what is its nature? What is its characteristic? What is happening here? And then when we observe the arising and passing away, that feeling arises, stays, passes away, arises, passes away. It's endlessly coming and endlessly going. And when we see that it's endlessly arising and passing away, then we realize that it's not a me doing this, it's just a process happening. Just like the sun rising and passing away, rising and passing away, rising and setting. It's got nothing to do with me, it just naturally happens. Feeling arises and passes away. Then what happens is one gives up the fear of pain and just watches. And that ability to give up fear of pain and just know and watch gives incredible strength and power of mind and incredible freedom of mind too, to not be under the control of fear. And therefore one can observe. And there are many people who have come to our Buddhist community who have come to learn meditation because of chronic pain. And often the way they actually teach people to deal with chronic pain is not through dependency on drugs, but actually through clarity and awareness of pain and the neutral observation of the nature of the pain, so that the mind separates from the pain. And when the mind separates from the pain, you become aware of the process. Just like when the mind is aware of the process of sleeping, you can know then. You don't get caught up in the process. So too, you can be aware of the process of feeling and not get caught up in the process. So too, you can be aware of the process of death and not be caught up in the process of death. One of the things that actually also happens in the process of dying is that the body functions start to turn off, don't they? The first thing we notice, you know, when someone's dying is obviously their ability to move becomes limited, their ability to speak stops and slows down and stops. Their ability to open their eyes and interact stops. And so the body functions are slowing down and coming to stillness. And what happens is the last of the sense organs, which are shutting off, the eyes shut, the nose, the sense of smell, taste, touch, shuts off. But the last one to shut off is the ear. Hearing is usually the last thing to go. And so that's why it's actually very important to be very mindful of what you say around a person who is dying. To say wise things, skillful things, beneficial things, caring things. And that can be absorbed and be known by the person. And then when the hearing shuts off, that's usually the time when then the mind will go to brilliance, go to a light when karma will come up, and then the mind, if the person is to die, is going to break up. And the mind will break up and go on to a new rebirth. Now, it's actually very interesting that recently in the Lancet, they had an article on near-death experiences, and they've done a scientific study which has just been printed in the Lancet, and I saw a copy of it the other day, where some Dutch scientists had a group of people, and they found that about 10% of that group of people, I think it was a fairly large survey group, had a near-death experience, an experience where the death process had happened, the body was shutting down, they couldn't feel, they couldn't speak, they couldn't taste, touch, hearing ceased, and then they had an experience in the mind of some process, usually a description, they described seeing a light, or they described it in many ways. But the point of the survey was to point out the percentage. One group, I think it was 11%, just over 10%, which they were presenting as evidence that there is something beyond just pure materialism. There isn't just the ending and death, that if a 10% group, it's a significant, statistically significant number, remember experiences. And these were people who had been defined as clinically dead by the medical profession. They had been their brain dead, clinically dead, but then they were revived. And in that being revived, 11% had this recollection of some near-death experience, which made the authors of that question, well, what happens? What happens with consciousness? What happens with perception? What happens with thought? What happens with memory if there is something there? It's not just a chemical process. It's not just a machine that switches off. There's obviously something else going on. And the Buddha described that process is, that is the process of the mind breaking up and going according to karmic actions. The habits that we've created in this life will come to the fore. Just like the habits you created in this life, the way you do things come to fore in unexpected ways. For example, if you're suddenly frightened, you're suddenly faced with death, then we react in a particular way. And it will be our habits. For example, if you're a person who swears, then suddenly if you get a shock, then this language just comes out. Yes. If you have cultivated the mind not to get into that habit, then if you get a shock, you'll react in a different way. It's the habit patterns, the conditioning that comes out, comes up in those situations. And so that affects how we respond. And same too in the next life. It's what we've done in this life or in the past lives. It's how we live, how we act, how we speak. It accumulates and collects over time. We get skillful habit patterns and unskillful habit patterns. And the important thing to do is to be cultivating skillful habit patterns. Because often we blame the person blame ourselves, but it's actually the behavior which is blamable, or the behavior which is praiseable. Good speech is just that, good speech. Good action is just that, good action. We see it as good, skillful, beneficial behavior and action to be cultivated and developed. And that will lead to karma, good karma in the future. So this quality of reflecting on the impermanent nature of existence is actually very important. It's a very important meditation subject. Most people think that if you think about death, you actually become very depressed. Actually quite the opposite. What I find as a monk is you're often dealing with people who are very depressed, who come to visit you, and they've never ever thought about death. They've never thought about death. It's usually the monks who I'm living with who think about death every day that are actually quite joyous to be around. And I wonder, well, why is that? Because it's that quality of, if you're faced with a sage, with a sword in front of you, you can't step back, you can't step forward, what's the most important thing to do? What's the most important time? Who's the most important person? So when you contemplate that I too will change, this life too will disappear, then we become very, very careful and very sensitive to how we deal with each other, how we interact, how we deal with ourselves, how we treat ourselves, and how we treat the world. And because, you know, when we contemplate that all of us are going to die, then it's a great leveler, isn't it? It's a great leveler in life. We, you know, our sense of ego, our sense of importance fades away, and we develop a great sense of compassion to the world, that all beings will be like us, will pass away, and we are like all beings. It's what unifies us. There is a commonality there, a common quality. It's the basis of humanity. And when we have that, then compassion comes forth. And we don't treat people insensitively or unkindly. Why should we? It may be the last thing we do. It may be the last words we say. It may be our very last thought. Do we want to go with this thought, with this act? And when we think in this way, then we become very, very skillful in training the mind, because it's sobering. It sobers up. So often we get caught up in the pettiness and the little things of life. And when we measure it against the great standard of the final act, our final stage call, then it puts it in the context, doesn't it? So the little argument we may have had today, the disagreement, the problem at work, the problem with our family, the problem with money, the problem with our love life, and the problem with our health, starts to fade away. It doesn't become so important. We put it in a context and we can let go of it. We can put it down and put it aside. It doesn't matter. If this is the last thing we do, this is what matters. This moment. To be clear, to be compassionate, to be bright, to be wise, to be skillful, to be alert. That's what matters. And this is actually how we sober the mind up. We develop this clear awareness, this awareness of the present moment, this clarity in the present moment, this skill with dealing with life and life problems. And I always suggest to people to not only consider your own death, but to consider the death of those around you. not in a death wish. That's not what we're doing. It's the idea of, well, if that person was to die today, how would I look at them? How would I look at them? And I assure you, you'll look at them totally differently. Because what it does is it brings forth compassion. It brings forth empathy. If we know that if this person was to die, would we be so critical? Would we be so judgmental? Would we treat them differently? And I'm sure we all would. Notice when we hear that someone has passed away, our mind is moved by compassion and empathy and sympathy. We want to help. Our heart goes out to that the relatives and friends. And so if we look around the people around us, then it will make us much more skillful in the way we deal with those people. We'll care for the people we're with. And that's also a very important form of meditation. So the Buddha said that there's four things that we should reflect on every day if we want to develop wisdom. The first thing is that I am of the nature to age. That overcomes the pride of youth because we see that this is a process that will happen. It will happen. I am of the nature to be sick. To get sick. That overcomes the pride of health because it will happen. It's the nature of a body. I am of the nature. We're saying this is a fact. This body is of the nature to die. And that is something to reflect on, to contemplate, to consider, not with fear, not seeing it as a taboo, but to look, oh, yes, what happens? And then to also see that we are the owners of our karma. We own our actions. What we sow, we reap. We are heirs to our actions. Our abide here and now is supported by how we act here and now. We're related to our actions. Whatever actions we do, of that we'll receive the results. So we become very skillful in how we act. With body, speech, and mind. So these are the four reflections to reflect wisely every day so that it leads to a clear, sober understanding of truth as it is. And because of this, then we actually then will live this life more skillfully, but also at the time of our own passing, then there'll be no fear. And certainly if a person has led a good life, then that's one of the direct benefits, that they die unconfused because they know they're going to go on a good way. Many years ago, I had a near-death experience myself, and it was actually very interesting because I saw the process of how that happens. I was sick at the time, and staying with two Thai monks who were very good friends of mine. And we happened to be living in a cremation ground, a cemetery. And we'd walked, travelled to this area, and we got to the range retreat and were spending the range retreat there. And there were a few simple huts built by the villagers there. And one day I wasn't feeling well, so my Thai friend decided that he'd make some herbal medicine for me. And he said this cured him, so it will cure me. And not very scientific, but it was coming from the right place. And so out of kind of just being polite to him, I took this medicine and I had an immediate reaction to it. I've never had that allergic reaction to medicines before, but I started to feel faint and I walked back to my hut, which was only about from here to the reception area away, and I collapsed in the room there. and then started hyperventilating and going into shock. And it was a very interesting experience, because what happened was I saw the habits of mind come in. The mind immediately clicked into meditation, even though the body was going into shock and was shaking, and the legs were thrashing about. The mind went very still. I had a vision of two monks who I'm very close to, meditation teachers who I know very well. One of them will be visiting here in a couple of weeks' time, because I'd spent a lot of time under these teachers. A vision of them came, and then I knew that if I died now, I'm going to go in a good way. So I just stayed mindfully aware of the mind and just watched what happened. I couldn't move my arms, open my eyes, couldn't speak, but my hearing was still operating. And I remember the two monks came over, Thun At and Thun Zombun, came over, and they saw me on the ground in shock, and they started massaging me, and they took this tiger balm, which all Thai monks always have, at the ready. It's a universal cure for everything. So I don't know whether he put that in the medicine I drank, but they started shoving this tiger balm up my nose and rubbing it on every imaginable part of the body. So, you know, it was cold and hot all over. And I could still hear them speak. And one of them was saying, oh, we'll have to go into the village and try and get a vehicle. And then Thun Zombun, my mind started to let go of the world. And it went down a very peaceful, bright, single point of light, just like in meditation, in mindfulness meditation of Samatha. And at that point, my hearing was just about to switch off when I heard him say, it was like a long distance away, like I just very heard this gentle voice saying, if he dies, I'll never forgive myself. And I just heard this, and then my mind was moved with compassion that I didn't want him to feel sorry that he did me in. And then the mind just shifted and started pulling out. Just slowly, slowly started coming back because of my feeling for my friend. And then over a long period of time, it took about another hour and a half, 2 hours, I could finally open my eyes. By that time, I was really covered in tiger balm. Probably wish I did die as well. It was actually a very interesting sort of seeing of the process. But the most important thing that I saw was actually that you get what you reap. You sow the good conditions, the good causes, you know how to deal with the mind, you've got nothing to worry about. It will just happen by itself. All those good things you've done, all those good states of mind, just come up. And you just let go, get out of the way, and then you go according to your good actions. And so I will end the talk right here, bring this talk to an end. But before I do, I thought, well, it seems it's been such a heavy talk on death, that I would end with a lovely joke that I've heard just recently, and not to be outdone by Achan Brom, who's on retreat, and I'm sure you're desperately missing him. I thought I'd tell you this joke. I was hoping that someone would go asleep at the end of at the back of the hall, because it would become meaningful for the joke. But there was a minister of religion, and he died, and he went up to heaven, and he got to the pearly gates, and he'd been teaching religion for 45 years, many disciples, spreading the word. Got to the pearly gates, And there was this fellow leaning against the pearly gates in a leather jacket, and tattoos all over him, sort of slick back hair, really rough looking character. And he was slouching against the pearly gates. And he said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Oh, my name's Sam McCarthy. I'm a taxi driver from New York." And anyway, St. Peter opened the pearly gates. And they go over to the big book of deeds. And they look through the deeds. And he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "Oh, I'm Sam McCarthy, taxi driver from New York." And St. Peter says, "Very good, very good, very good. You've done very well. Your palace is waiting for you over there. Here's a golden robe. And we have the trumpeteers ready to welcome you." And so the taxi driver is very happy and he wanders off. And then he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "My name's Ian Smith, Reverend Ian Smith. I've been spreading the word on earth for 45 long years. So what is my reward?" And St. Peter looks through the book and says, "Very good, yes, yes. Yes, your bungalow is over there. Here's your bronze robe. And there's one trumpeter waiting for you." And he said, "What do you mean? The taxi driver from New York, he got a palace. He got many trumpeters. He got a golden robe. I've been teaching God's word on earth for 45 long years, and I get a bungalow." And St. Peter says, "Well, look, there's been a policy change here at the moment. We're going by deeds, by results these days. And what we've noticed is every time you gave a sermon over those 45 years, everyone fell asleep. But whenever someone got into that fellow's taxi, they prayed to God."